Hello and welcome to New Netherland Praatjes, a series of chats on the Dutch colony of New Netherland, brought to you by the New Netherland Institute and the New Netherland Research Center in Albany, New York. Praatjes is Dutch for chat, and these are informal conversations with historians, archaeologists, and other experts on the world of the 17th century Dutch.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the August 2018 New Netherland Praatjes, episode number 13. I am Steve Mackerlane, director of the New Netherland Institute. For this interview, my colleague, Mr. Russell Shorto, and I were joined by Dr. Peter Van Cleve. Peter has a PhD in history from Arizona State University, where he is currently a lecturer of history. His research interests include the Dutch-American Atlantic world in the Age of Revolutions, the political and religious history of the early American Republic, and religious tolerance and intolerance in the Revolutionary Era. Peter joined us because the subject of his dissertation, Francis Adrian Vanderkamp, was the first person to translate a large part of New Netherland's records, which he did in the early 19th century. Peter's work first came to my attention at our 2015 annual conference, where he gave an excellent talk on Vanderkamp's translations and challenged a nearly universal negative view of Vanderkamp's work. Peter then turned this talk into an article titled Rescuing the Albany Records from the Fire, Francis Adrian Vanderkamp's Notorious Attempt to Translate the Records of New Netherland, which appeared in the journal New York History in 2015. Listening back to the interview, one of the things that struck me was how difficult it is to understand someone's circumstances, particularly over 200 years ago, and how important it is to put a person's actions in their unique historical context. So you'll hear over this interview all these challenges that Vanderkamp faced that a person doing that job now would never face. And it's quite easy to overlook these things when thinking about someone centuries ago. So that is one of the key themes of the interview, and something that I think is always important to keep in mind when thinking about the past. First, who is Vanderkamp, and how did you become interested in him?
Right. So Vanderkamp is one of those historical figures in the kind of Forrest Gumpian sense, which is one of the reasons that really drew me to researching him, you know, somewhat exclusively. He's one of those people that just seems to be everywhere and involved in everything. He was involved in the Dutch Patriot Revolt, played both a major role in terms of literally leading a military unit. He also published and spread the most famous pamphlet to the people of the Netherlands, written by Van der Kaplan. Those efforts, his actions during the Patriot Revolt actually resulted in him being jailed for a period of 6 months, and really actually led to him being banished from several of the provinces in the Netherlands. He quickly realized that life in the Netherlands wouldn't be for him, and so he contacted one of his good friends, John Adams, to secure him passage to the United States. So my interest was largely in trying to explore the Dutch Revolutionary Era. My initial kind of foray was to see, you know, how did Dutch Americans react to the revolution? But initially, there didn't seem to be a whole lot there that wasn't covered. But then this name for Vanderkamp kept popping up. And so the more and more I got into his life, the more and more I got into his actions, he seemed like kind of prime for studying both the Revolutionary Atlantic and then into the early Republic. He kind of hits this nice sweet spot between the most significant periods of Dutch American history, the first being the New Netherland colony, and the second being the larger immigrations of Dutch people starting in about 1840 into the late 19th century. So he kind of was this untapped resource, both historically, but also historiographically, that I thought would be really interesting to explore as a topic.
Peter, Russell here. Give us an idea of how this piece of research fits into your overall interests and your background. You are a specialist in early American studies, American colonial studies. So, I mean, I guess you touched on it just there. He's a bridge between the 17th century and the 18th century worlds. Maybe you can sketch out a little bit your own, the sweep of your own interests.
Yeah, certainly. Funnily, the translations didn't play a major role in my initial research. This was actually something I came to later. But what would really excited me about Vanderkamp, what I find really interesting is his involvement in the politics of the age, both in terms of the Dutch Patriot Revolt, but also his involvement, his continued involvement in the United States. He made a lot of contacts, our contacts during the Patriot Revolt, John Adams, Henry Lawrence, and he used those contacts to get letters of introduction in the United States. So he carried with him across the Atlantic letter of introductions to George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, and George Clinton were actually part of the welcoming party that met the ship Vanderkamp and his family were on at the docks. And then greater than that was his involvement as a preacher, both in the Netherlands and in the United States. And in particular, the kind of scope of what I look at for his religious life is his continued descent of established religions. So in the Netherlands, he was a constant critic of the Reformed Church. He was actually banished and expelled from the University of Groningen as a result of his beliefs and his writings. He went through a kind of personal reflection on the nature of Jesus, the nature of God, actually expressed what would be called today Unitarian beliefs, although I don't know if Vanderkamp would label himself kind of specifically toward a denomination. And he carried those beliefs into the United States. So he actually founded a church in upstate New York. Currently, it's in Barneveld. It is now the Unitarian Church of Barneveld, which actually still holds services to this day. It was a church founded in 1803, and they still hold services. They hold, in fact, a pilgrimage service every June in honor of Vanderkamp and his contributions, both to their congregation, but also to religious liberty in U.S. history and the kind of expansion of Unitarianism outside of Boston.
Just to touch on and pick up on that, that longevity suggests that he had quite an appeal as a preacher.
Yeah, so he there is actually a fairly famous cartoon from the Dutch Patriot Revolt, and it shows Vanderkamp literally in the pulpit, half of him dressed in his reverend robes and the other half dressed as a soldier. So Vanderkamp became a point of emphasis within the Dutch Patriot Revolt as kind of this dangerous blending of civic and religious dissent in the Netherlands. And then his appeal, interestingly, I would argue his appeal wasn't as popular at the time. So Barneveld is located right outside of Utica. So he was right in the heart of the Burndover district. He was right in the heart of all of those Finney revivals. In fact, his church experienced some restriction, some forms of oppression in those early years. Presbyterians, for example, wouldn't agree to share the same space as the Unitarian Church. The first minister, John Sherman, received several examples, particularly from Daniel Dow, arguments questioning his faith, questioning his responsibilities as a minister. And in fact, in 1826, there was a mini controversy at the church where Presbyterians were able to gain enough representation within the church that they nominated their own reverend in order to kick out the Unitarian reverend. And Vanderkamp had to step in, use his cultural and kind of social authority within the church and the surrounding community, and ensure that the church continued to be Unitarian after that moment. So he actually, in terms of the larger scope of American history, he's part of this smaller group of dissenters who kind of stood against the wave of evangelicalism that was the hallmark of the Second Great Awakening.
Okay, so he arrived in the United States when?
He arrived in 1788.
Okay. And so from there, and he did the translations in around 1820?
So he worked 1817 is when DeWitt Clinton contacted him. He agreed to do the job starting in January of 1818, and he worked until 1822.
So by the time he gets this job, who was the one who said he was the greatest scholar in the country? Was that Clinton?
Yeah, DeWitt Clinton. He said, I have found in an unassuming village in the wilderness the most learned man in America.
Was it his religious activities that established that reputation?
I think it was more his political activities, but also I think Clinton, like many Americans, were just impressed with his sheer realm of knowledge. So English, for example, was, I think, his sixth language. And it was language he actually picked up rather quickly, never really mastered it. One of the things, if you ever have the time to read a bunch of Vanderkemp documents, something that is constantly commented on is his imperfect grasp of English, which naturally doesn't make him the best translator. Yeah. For Dutch documents. But as I said, so I think he met John Adams in 1781 in April, and by September of that same year, so their first letter was in French. By September of that year, their correspondence was done in English and conducted in English from 1781 until Adams's death in 1826.
Okay, Peter, what your paper does, and we're going to ask you to walk through, is sort of a debunking of a popular understanding of his work, popular at least among people in the New Netherland field. But maybe first you can explain or outline what that view is. How do people view the Albany record, so-called?
Yeah, so the initial response was actually quite positive. So essentially kind of from 1822 until really E.B. O'Callaghan started working on the documents. The documents were the only English translation that people were able to use. So I think some of this was ignorance of the documents. But you know, it was widely hailed as you know, an interesting and useful history, starting with E.B. O'Callaghan and really moving forward until 1911. So E.B. O'Callaghan and in particular A.J. Van Laer, both of them realized and recognized that the translations were imperfect. O'Callaghan was a little more lenient toward Vanderkemp. He suggested to the state that they need to redo these, that they are imperfect, whereas A.J. Van Laer argued that they were absolutely worthless for his critical historical work and that they were so poor they need not be considered at all. And so this was the assessment. In 1911, of course, there was the Capitol fire. Almost all of Vanderkemp's records were destroyed in that fire. And so there was this kind of brief period where the general assessment was, you know, we'll never know if they were that bad. You know, in particular, Harry Jackson, who has written the only biography on Vanderkemp, he says, you know, we'll never know about this. You know, they probably aren't as bad as everyone says. However, Charlie Gehring, of course, found two surviving volumes of Vanderkemp's translations. And he quickly informed me that, no, they are just as bad. They aren't useful for anyone who wanted to do, you know, kind of serious historical work on the New Netherland colony. And this is the established view that Vanderkemp's records and translations were worthless. That's probably the word used most often by people assessing the records, and that they shouldn't really be considered as a part of this scholarship.
And yet they influenced the historical record. For the most part, the way we know about them is quotes and references that people make to them in the 19th century, where they just refer to them as the Albany records.
Right. Yeah, correct. Even through O'Callaghan, heavily relied on the Albany records, and you know his documentary history of New York is influenced by the Albany records, influenced by Vanderkemp's translation, which you're exactly right. It kind of feeds into this concern that Van Laer and others have about those histories that had been written based on the Albany records. I mean, one of the things that Vanderkemp did do was that he opened this history for a great number of people. Now, the history is produced by those people, you know, are somewhat, you know, affected by Vanderkemp's selective translations. But the reach of the Albany records is certainly greater than the legacy that Vanderkemp had coming out, you know, particularly the 1970s.
Sure. I mean, 19th century histories, even without a so-called bad translation, have plenty of problems to our eyes. So,
right.
You know, so I'm interested in what, and you go into this in your article, that his objective was not to do a word for word translation. Now, do you know, was that a common practice during the day to kind of summarize, or was he, even by the standards of the day, was he taking a lot of liberties with his translation?
Right. That's an excellent question. I don't know definitively, and I don't know about much other translation practices at that time. I think certainly if you look at O'Callaghan, who beginning his work, I believe in 1840, in the 1840s, he's already commenting on the problematic nature of the Vanderkemp translations. You know, and so Vanderkemp ending in 1822, it gives us an approximate in terms that Vanderkemp was kind of uniquely approaching these records. This wasn't a common practice in terms of kind of selectively translating and building really kind of volumes that reflect the translations as opposed to a line for line literal translation of the text.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that either, but I mean, I'm sure a lot from 1820 to 1840, whatever, a lot had changed in how history was done and how that was done. So I wouldn't be surprised if the environment in which he and O'Callaghan were in were very different as far as translations. But I think I jumped ahead a little bit. So tell us what it is that you argue he was trying to do with.
Actually, before you get to that, it strikes me that we might, for people's understanding of what it is we're talking about, the body of material. This is the material that Charlie Gehring has been translating since 1974. So that's 40 plus years working on this material, 12,000 plus pages, the official corpus of records of the Dutch colony of New Netherland. And that was what Vanderkemp had the commission to translate initially in the early part of the 19th century.
Yeah, and O'Callaghan translated fast by modern day standards, but not as fast as Vanderkemp. How long did it take, Peter, for him to do?
This is probably a good place to differentiate between how long it took him versus how long he was able to work on them.
Okay.
So he worked on them for 4 years, right? Which is an unbelievable rate for turning in those around. So he produced 24 folio volumes of records. I think Van Laer provides some details. He says 10,000 plus pages, 10,206 pages, 1,837,000, I think 80 words. I don't know why Van Laer would have that information to provide. And that's really specific, but an important part of Vanderkemp's environment in terms of when he was translating, is that he really had the tenure of DeWitt Clinton to finish those records. Right. I mean, he was a political appointment. This was a job paid for by the state. It was linked with DeWitt Clinton. As long as DeWitt Clinton was governor, Vanderkemp could be assured that he'd have a supporter. They would have funds to work on these documents. But it became pretty evident, particularly as the, you know, Martin Van Buren and the Bucktails revised the New York Constitution, that DeWitt Clinton's days were numbered. And so Vanderkemp just blew through these translations, knowing full well that his goal was to get them done, but he had 4 years essentially to get them done.
And backing up from that, why was it important to DeWitt Clinton to have this work done?
DeWitt Clinton, of course, comes from a Dutch lineage himself. And, you know, there was actually, well before DeWitt Clinton, I think actually under George Clinton, in 1804, there was a law that was passed to facilitate the translation of the Dutch records. They hired James Van Ingen to do this. He sat on the documents for quite some time. Actually, Vanderkemp had to petition the state to go to Van Ingen's house and collect the documents he had so that Vanderkemp could have the entire records that the state of New York had. But DeWitt Clinton, much like Vanderkemp, saw great value in learning from the Dutch. He saw that there were, believed that there were a lot of lessons to be had in this scholarship. There's a lot of things to be learned about the state of New York.
So he gives Vanderkemp the commission, and he understands, I guess, from the beginning that time is of the essence.
Yes. Yeah. So Vanderkemp brings in the services of his daughter. He is using all of the resources at his disposal in terms of being able to translate these records as quickly as he can. In fact, he doesn't even get them all done. When he finishes in 1822, DeWitt Clinton is out of office, and the state actually sends him another volume. And the state also owes him a payment on the previous volume. So Vanderkemp actually flat out refuses to touch the last volume and ends up sending it back to the state untranslated.
And is there a political back and forth on this question of I mean, is it like a political hot potato or something? The translation of this document, do Clinton's opponents not want it to be done?
There isn't. I didn't find much in Clinton's papers in terms of people challenging until his term was up. So 1821, 1822, there are some exchanges where Clinton is essentially letting Vanderkemp know. So Vanderkemp is doing this in Oldenbarneveld. So he's not doing this in Albany. So DeWitt Clinton at times is his proxy for these conversations. And Clinton relates to him that there are some representatives who are questioning the value of spending all of this money on the Dutch translations. They are questioning whether this is a good expenditure for the state, something that the state itself should be invested in. And Vanderkemp is incensed. He takes this as a particular affront to himself, to his relationship with DeWitt Clinton, to the work that he's doing. Essentially, any insult that Vanderkemp could take from this, he certainly did. So there is some evidence that politicians, and particularly opponents of DeWitt Clinton, were challenging the viability of this project and the necessity of the project. But I didn't see that. I didn't see much in, you know, say 1818 to 1821, but 1821 to 1822, you get more wind of these kind of the churn of the tide for DeWitt Clinton's immediate political career as governor.
I mean, this was a period where there were these big questions about the nature or the role of government spending, whether these types of projects should be taken on. And that, along with, of course, this view of the Dutch, which at this point, of course, it was dominated by Irving's account throughout the entire century. So, I mean, those two things come together. You could see why he faced such resistance. And one of the things that struck me in the article was how you were surprised that Vanderkemp was surprised at these basic details of New Netherland. Like, for example, that the fur trade was the impetus for Fort Orange, stuff like that. So it really is striking how little was known about New Netherland in this period.
Yeah, it was incredibly shocking. Like even well before Vanderkemp, it's kind of a comedy of errors leading up to Vanderkemp's work on the translation. So the very first attempt that I found was in 1798. A Reverend Samuel Miller kind of set a course for himself to try to write a definitive history of New York. And he submitted to the legislature this long list of questions, the first of which was, when was the colony? Like he didn't have literally when the colony existed. Also, the legislature, I don't know if they directly answered his questions, but eventually he got possession of the documents. He didn't realize that they were in Dutch. So, and he didn't read Dutch. And so he abandoned that project, or at least abandoned that part of the project.
It's easy to forget how little people knew about it. Of course, the records being in Dutch was a big part of that.
Right, exactly. And that's so the state decided, okay, we'll get someone to actually work on this. So, this is where the 1804 law comes in that says we need to get these documents translated. That's when they tap James Van Ingen. He can read Dutch. He should be able to do these things, but he just sat on the documents. So the first guy can't read Dutch, wants to translate them, but can't. The second guy can read Dutch and translate them, but decides not to. And then in comes Vanderkemp, someone who both has the skills as well as the desire to see this accomplished. But yeah, to get back to your point, it was surprising, because while we don't have the rest of his volumes, we have the two that do exist. But most of this exists in his correspondence from, 1817 really on. The translations remain a constant part of the letters that he wrote, in particular to John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, of course, DeWitt Clinton, but also his fellow Dutch compatriots. So John Linkland, who worked for the Holland Land Company, Adam Mappa, who lived in the same town as Vanderkemp, they're receiving essentially all this information and all this stuff that Vanderkemp is finding in the records. And it is. It's just astonishing, just the basic information. The fur trade was important. Slavery existed. Religion was complicated in the colony. All these kind of basic facts that we have today, they were all brand new for Vanderkemp, who had no real connection to, and neither did anyone of his correspondents. Clinton couldn't offer any advice or kind of direction of where to study. Adams was particularly interested in these, but he didn't have that kind of information, and neither did Jefferson. So, you know, two really learned people themselves, they were just as in the dark about the Dutch, about New Netherland, as was Vanderkemp.
Okay, so that's a really interesting, you know, sketch of the ignorance. However, not long before this, Washington Irving creates this, you know, somewhat fictional picture of New Netherland based on the similar material. So Irving had access, and Irving was able to portray something. So on the one hand, I guess what Vanderkemp is doing is reacting to Irving, trying to create a more realistic picture. But on the other hand, I wonder, well, there was all this ignorance, and yet Irving was able to, at least in some way, penetrate the darkness.
Right. Yeah. Irving's, so his history of New York comes out in 1809. So yeah, that kind of stood as the dominant model for Dutch history for most New Yorkers. I mean, that was certainly their best exposure to that history. Although, so certainly from Vanderkemp's perspective and others, it was the caricature of the Dutch in Irving's work, right? The Dutch as this kind of bumbling, you know, bumbling buffoons. They're lazy. They are not the image of the Dutch, certainly, that we are accustomed to. So Vanderkemp was certainly writing directly against this image, against this dominant kind of portrayal of the Dutch that came out of Irving's work.
And yet, just to follow that, pursue that a little further, there's this vast ignorance, but Washington was able to do something. He was able to look at the historical record, even if what he ended up creating was what we would call a fiction or a caricature.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, what is interesting about that, and also what is telling, is the vacuum of information that Irving was able to fill when it came to the Dutch. There wasn't anything that was set to counter his portrayal. Also, too, I mean, you know, he takes on the persona, right? He writes through the vein of Diedrich Knickerbocker. But I you know, not having access to the Dutch records, you know, certainly historians would argue this, right? That you need to go to the original source material. You need to have some access to those, which the records being untranslated, Irving did not have. He had recollections, he had folklore, and there's actually, when I worked on this piece, there was a dissertation that I read that actually compared Irving's work in the Dutch folklore and said that he actually pulled a lot of, you know, correct things from the information that he was able to access in terms of the Dutch, their customs, their culture. But what he didn't have access to, and what Vanderkemp wanted people to have access to, were the actual documents from the colony.
Yeah, that was by Lees Funk, a dissertation.
Yeah, yeah, right.
I think the only thing Irving really had was this skeleton of who were the director generals, and then he just ran with it. Mm-hmm. So I guess when you're doing satirical stuff, it's easy to kind of put meat on the bones. But as far as like real concrete information, there was so little.
But I think it, you know, Irving and Vanderkemp, these two projects, the way they went about them and the way they were looked at initially, says something about what history was, or how people perceived history and a view of the past, that you could look at something that was clearly intended as a kind of fictional satire, and that could stand as the historical record until, like, Vanderkemp comes along, and we haven't yet asked you to go into what he ends up doing, which is not at all what a historian today would consider to be a translation project. And that stands for a while as a pretty straight up historical rendering.
Yeah, that's interesting. Irving actually reissues his second edition. He includes a kind of a apology to people who wrote to him that said, this isn't a good portrayal of the Dutch. You are misrepresenting these figures. And so I think that came out in 1842. And so he kind of adds a note onto this, and actually uses O'Callaghan's history to say, I've added this material in. I've kind of bulked this up to provide a different image of the Dutch.
Yeah, and it being Irving, it's hard to know how serious to take that apology.
Right, right.
So, but yeah, no, he had several editions and, you know, continued to make money, obviously. In 1909, at the Hudson Fulton celebration, they were still complaining about Irving being the historian of 100 years later. Piece of satire. No one could break through it.
Yeah, it took forever. And Ted Burroughs used to give a talk about how what perpetuated that was political cartoonists using those characters as caricatures and using them to whatever, make whatever political points of the day. So that perpetuated, in a strange way, Washington or Irving's image of the period.
Yeah, it was certainly that. And I also suspect it was just his work was so much more entertaining than everyone else's.
Sure, that counts for something.
I think it's without doubt that in terms of the two images that come out of this era, Irving's has greater purchase and a greater impact on how people think of the Dutch in those years following.
What did, if he did not do a line-by-line translation, what did Vanderkemp do with these documents?
So what I argue is that his intent was to write a history of New Netherland, that more than anything, more than trying to say, here is this sentence in Dutch, here is its equivalent in English, he provided more summaries of the documents. So if you think about his volume would be an approximation of the information that would be contained in the Dutch documents. It would still be true to the intent of what the documents said. It would still reflect the information that was in the documents, but it would also be filtered through Vanderkemp's own perspective. One of the things that tipped me to this, well, kind of two things, is as I was working on this project, my initial intent when I encountered Vanderkemp, encountered the translations, and encountered all of these overwhelmingly negative portrayals is, I'm going to vindicate Vanderkemp. They can't be this bad. I kind of took the Harry Jackson route. They can't be this bad. There has to be some value to them as translations. And it wasn't until, you know, I kind of put time into this article and the paper that I presented at the conference, and I was working with a colleague of mine, and she noted, she asked me, you know, is translation the best term to think about this? And that is when I really had the aha moment that Vanderkemp wasn't trying to issue a translation in the way that we would think about this. What he was really trying to do was relate the documents, to take this bundle of Dutch records and produce a summary of it in English so that people had a direct representation of the Dutch colony from the Dutch records. And the second part of that was a letter that he wrote to Adams. And in the letter, he says that, you know, here's this bundle of documents. It's about economics. It's about kind of bureaucratic stuff. You know, it's about, you know, mathematical and scientific information. He says, you know, if it was anyone other than me, they might be interested in this stuff, but it's really not to my taste. And, you know, one of the things that Van Laer noted was Vanderkemp's tendency to skip sentences, to leave out information. And so those kind of two features combined led me to the realization, or at least the argument, that this was Vanderkemp's history of New Netherland that he was providing for the state of New York, that it wasn't a translation, but that it was better understood as his interpretation of these documents and the salient details that they held for understanding the colony.
And this gets back to your point that time was of the essence for him. He had to get this done while Clinton was still in office.
Right. Yeah.
So he had to rush.
Exactly. Yeah. It provided a way. So the environment played a role in terms of exactly. He had essentially 4 years to translate all of these documents. He wasn't able to take it on his leisure. I also haven't mentioned yet that Vanderkemp was going blind. He literally has moments where he's pouring poison into his eyes as a curative, pouring belladonna into his eyes. So there's a number of factors that do not lend themselves to a successful and accurate translation project.
It takes longer than 4 years to do one with the work that Yanni and Charlie are doing. I mean, Yanni has transcribed all these. Even with a complete transcription, it takes longer than 4 years generally to do one volume. And he did them all in 4 years. So
So, and this is the heart of your argument, Peter, right? That you're partially vindicating him by saying he didn't intend to do what people are later complaining that he didn't do well.
Yes, exactly. That Vanderkemp, we should see Vanderkemp less as the first person that translated the New Netherland documents, and more as one of the first complete histories of the New Netherland colony.
And I guess what clouded that picture is, I mean, had he attempted to write a history and quote liberally from the original materials, that confusion wouldn't have existed. But what he did was instead a kind of quasi-translation that made it confusing for people.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I think the initial intent, certainly, his actions at the beginning, and also all of the ways in which the Albany records are described. They're described as the complete translation of the New Netherland documents. Vanderkemp himself is particularly initially, adopts, that kind of language, adopts that approach. But what I argue is, as you see in his correspondence, he kind of quickly moves away from translations proper and more into kind of summary. More into selectively choosing those things that he thinks are most representative.
Okay. You mentioned that he quickly moved away. I was going to ask you that. Does his correspondence indicate that he bit off a lot more than he could chew, that he expected to be able to do a translation, and he started doing this and he was like, oh boy, this is a lot harder than I expected. Do you think that's what happened?
I think that that's certainly part of it. I think, I mean, even at the start, he was wary of the amount of time he would be able to dedicate to the project. He was one of those scholars that had 50 projects going at the same time, most of which never came to completion. Also, too, the logistics of how do we get the documents from Albany to Oldenbarneveld? How do I get them back to you? He was also worried about his language skills. He would be the first to admit that he calls it his uncouth language, but he was also concerned. In fact, one of the first editions that he sent to the state, and he was working with Van Yates, and he asked him, he's like, do a check of this for me. Is this good? Is this the kind of stuff that you guys want? And I never saw anything in return from Yates or from the state that said, no, we want that these aren't the kind of translations that we're looking for. And there wasn't any kind of feedback that Vanderkemp got. So what I argue, and kind of what seems to have happened, is he just kept doing what he had done initially. And he kind of took that as solace. He took that as approval from the state that what he was doing was fine, and that he should continue to do those things.
In the paper, you also put his work in the context, the political context of New York vis-a-vis, I guess, New England at the time. I'm going to read a couple of sentences from your paper. You say, as Vanderkemp labored, New York became the most populous state in the Union, attracting a host of new settlers, including many Yankees from nearby New England. New Yorkers witnessed the building of the Erie Canal and felt the rippling social and religious effects of the market revolution. They saw the expansion of democracy through the normalization of intense party politics, and a generation born after the American Revolution grappled anew with what it meant to be American. Vanderkemp's recapturing of Dutch history was a response to the political, religious, and social context of post-revolutionary New York. As the state became a new American melting pot, he saw the records as an opportunity to present a model of how a politically and religiously pluralistic society could successfully function. Say a little more about that, that context that he was using this work of his to put forth a new model for where the nation ought to be going at that moment in history.
Right. Yeah. And so the two kind of threads, the political thread and the religious thread, were a part of his personal life. One of the things that I didn't get as much into this article that I think was actually in one of the first versions was Vanderkemp himself, when he arrived in the United States, right? He arrived right you know, at the start of the French Revolution, the 1790s, and just that immense and tumultuous period that is typified by really intense partisanship, really intense party politics. Vanderkemp himself tried to navigate, you know, he certainly supported Adams. I think it would be safe to argue he had more Federalist tendencies than he did Republican tendencies. But he also considered Jefferson a friend. He also considered Jefferson an esteemed politician. There's actually a kind of funny moment in the early 1800s. He writes a article comparing Jefferson and Buffon, comparing the notes on the state of Virginia with Comte de Buffon's criticisms. And he submits this to Adams and a Federalist Society, who rejected out of hand. The feedback he got was, this is really good work. It's incredibly learned, but it's about Jefferson. We will never publish anything about Jefferson. And so he took that and kind of internalized it. And he was fearful for what the nation would become. Certainly it hit its height in the late 1790s. It hit its height with Adams and the quasi-war, the kind of engagement with the French, the, you know, moves that Napoleon was doing in the Atlantic, the French were doing in the Atlantic, concurrently doing similar things in the Netherlands, right? So the French essentially operate with the Dutch Republic as a satellite state during this period. And so Vanderkemp sees these measures as a direct threat to American independence, and he sees the intense partisanship as weakening the bonds that Americans have. So he sees the New Netherland documents and these efforts of these heterogeneous settlers, these people that are coming from a wide variety of backgrounds. You know, I think it's David Cohen's article that notes that the Dutch are barely a majority in the colony. The Dutch colony is always about questions of how do you navigate a pluralistic society. And so kind of politically, Vanderkemp knew he would find lessons in the colony that would connect with the ever-present lessons that he was going through at the time. You know, he himself being Dutch, living in what was essentially a Dutch enclave in upstate New York on land that was purchased by the Dutch owned Handel Hall and Land Company. He knew fully well the role that the Dutch had played in colonial and now, you know, U.S. history. And so he was hopeful that he would find information and kind of find lessons in how the Dutch administered their colony. And religiously, the same measure. As I mentioned earlier, he was a dissenter when it came to religious practices, both in the Netherlands and in the United States. As I said, he formed a church in 1803. They build a building in 1806 because the Presbyterians in the town refuse to hold and share the same space with them. You know, he sees and hopes that the religious pluralism of the Dutch and the kind of thorniness that is Dutch tolerance can provide lessons for Americans to use, especially now that disestablishment was the law of the land, that there wasn't the state church, much like the Dutch didn't technically have a state church. What lessons could be gleaned from how the Dutch navigate similar issues?
That's so interesting that he actually saw New Netherland as a model for how America should move forward.
Yeah. As he was getting toward the end of his research, the end of the translations, it kind of hit him with even more force. I mean, so he was always of the opinion that the Dutch could be useful to the United States, both in terms of a literal ally, but also in terms of histories. So the New Netherland documents weren't the only piece of scholarship that he produced in terms of uniting both the Dutch Republic and the American Republic. And in fact, I think the book that came out of the conference, I'd slightly tweaked that. And what I argue is that the Albany records are one part of this larger life of scholarship and history on the Dutch American Atlantic and the kind of unification of these two spheres. And so Vanderkemp sees this as significantly important for understanding the Dutch past as a way to understand the American future.
Would you say that there was that he succeeded in some sense? Did people in the immediate aftermath of the publication or of the translation cotton onto that?
I think one of the more significant pieces of evidence is the Irving edition, which, you know, he cites O'Callaghan, who was using Vander Kemp's translations in terms of creating his own history. So I do think there were ripple effects. However, I would say that overall it doesn't seem to land, certainly in the way that Vander Kemp hoped that it would. He and Adams, he later in life, so I mean, this is near Adams's death in 1826. Vander Kemp is making similar comments, you know, in his death in 1829, that if only Americans knew about the history of the Dutch in New Netherland, or if only Americans knew how important the Dutch were to the foundation of the United States, life would be much better. So he was still lamenting this right up until his death. So I would say that overall, there are some rippling effects, but in the immediate aftermath, certainly in Vander Kemp's eyes, he didn't see it as having the type of effect he hoped that it would.
Broadhead's history is published around 1840.
I think it's late 1848, or I think it's similar.
He seems to take up this the spirit of behind what you're saying is behind Vander Kemp's translations, and I think also in a way that doesn't go anywhere. People don't buy that argument.
Yeah, I mean, does O'Callaghan pick that up? Do you think?
I think to some extent, yeah, but I think he's a little bit more muted with.
Yeah.
Another thing that you do that's interesting, Peter, is you liken Vander Kemp's translation project with the Erie Canal. Can you elaborate that?
Yeah. So they literally follow similar trajectories chronologically, right? Erie Canal construction is begun in 1817. The first kind of leg of it is finished in 1822. And so the central link, though, of course, is DeWitt Clinton. DeWitt Clinton as the significant promoter of the Erie Canal, right? Jefferson calls it Clinton's ditch. He doesn't think that it's a terribly good idea. But it's also about the transformation of New York society. You know, we mentioned the Yankee migration that is only going to intensify after the Erie Canal. And so I kind of frame them as Clinton's big projects during this period, you know, with the Erie Canal being so successful and so clearly politically advantageous that, for example, the you know, Van Buren and the Bucktails, they can't argue with the canal. Van Buren is somewhat dismissive, certainly early on, but once it becomes clear that the canal is going to be a success, it pretty becomes a non-issue politically. However, the translations do, right? I mentioned that there were some grumblings about the money being spent paying Vander Kemp, the money being spent on the translations themselves. And it's kind of this interesting dynamic in terms of capturing the transformation of New York society, but also these political transformations, because Vander Kemp's project will never have the same type of viability that the Erie Canal will have, and therefore it becomes a political liability as well.
What have reactions been to this sort of partial this reappraisal of Vander Kemp that you've done?
So the feedback that I got at the conference was quite positive. I know Yanni and Charlie both kind of were nodding their head when I was using Vander Kemp's own descriptions of what it was like to work on these documents. You know, he describes it at one point as deciphering hieroglyphics. And that's Yanni came up to me after the talk and she's like, that's exactly what it's like. He's like, captured that perfectly. But I think, you know, the kind of reception of the additional value of Vander Kemp's work has seemed to landed fairly well with people who are much better versed in the actual documents than I am. My whole goal was just about a different way of thinking about Vander Kemp's legacy and Vander Kemp's work on the documents. And so it was really refreshing. And, you know, I was really excited to hear Charlie's response to it, which he was positive, He was one that first told me that as translations, they wouldn't work. And that's what actually led me down the path of I need to find a different angle to understand these documents. It's been quite nice.
Yeah, that's wonderful. It's a really useful addition to New Netherlands studies. Did you have something else on the? I was going to back up and ask Peter more broadly what he's working on and what he's been working on since then.
One thing before that, talk a little bit more about John Adams. I'm really interested in Adams's reaction to what Vanderkemp said, him being a New Englander and having that pedigree. The New England, New Netherland thing will never not fascinate me. So tell me more about what Adams, how he reacted to. And he was completely ignorant, right? He knew nothing about this before.
Right, exactly. Yeah, completely ignorant, but just as interesting, invested as Vanderkemp. He was genuinely interested in any and all of the information that Vanderkemp was able to find and relate. The letters that Adams returned. So Vanderkemp would kind of send off a letter like, "Oh, here's all this stuff that I found," and Vanderkemp would keep pressing him. Adams would ask, "Hey, did you find?" Or he was like, "Hey, I ran into somebody who had a Dutch name. Did you find him?" In any of the records, one of the greatest exchanges was about the role of religion. Adams really pressed Vanderkemp. He's like, did the Dutch banish any Quakers? Because, of course, famously in New England, they executed Quakers for blasphemy and for public disruption. And so Adams was interested in finding out whether or not the Dutch were just as bad as New Englanders. And so when Vanderkemp said, "Yeah, I did find evidence that they banished a Quaker, sent him back to Amsterdam," Adams was actually quite relieved. He's like, at least the Dutch are just as bad as my Yankee ancestors.
So can you give us an idea of what you have been working on since this paper? Are you working on a book?
Yes, very slowly. Working on a book on Vanderkemp and kind of his life and the political and religious connections between the Dutch Republic and the American Republic. So it is tentatively titled A Shadow of Liberty. And so one of the things I just actually published with the Journal of Early American History, which will be part of the book, is I wrote an article on Adams and Vanderkemp and the quasi-war of 1798. In that article, I argue that in order to understand why Adams went to war with the French, you actually have to understand Adams's connection to the Dutch people and the Dutch Republic. And the best way to do that, of course, is through Vanderkemp. Vanderkemp was his most constant communique. He did have John Quincy Adams, who was in the Netherlands at the time. And so part of this argument is that the Dutch are an important element to understanding the early American Republic. And there's been a kind of general neglect of this period when it comes to the Dutch.
So you're using Vanderkemp as a way to broaden the understanding of the relationship between the early American Republic and the Netherlands.
Right, exactly. In religious terms, kind of one of the connections that I try to make is that the church that he forms in Oldenbarneveld is really a church that is born out of a Dutch context. In part, literally, it's founded on land that is owned by the Holland Land Company. Many of its congregants early on were Dutch immigrants like Vanderkemp. But also, too, the ethos of it, there are really strong echoes between the religious environment in the United States that Vanderkemp experienced and the religious environments in the Netherlands that he experienced. And so, yeah, trying to use Vanderkemp as a way to understand these larger moments in American history, the Second Great Awakening, the emergence of partisan politics in the 1790s. Vanderkemp was also involved in the War of 1812. So that's one of the focuses as well.
Okay, Peter, the book sounds great. Excellent stuff today. Thank you for joining us.
It sounds fun. It sounds interesting.
Oh, thank you very much. And it was a pleasure being on there. And thank you for inviting me.